You're playing on Thursday evening, Steve, as part of the Bulmers Leopardstown Festival. That's this Thursday.
That's right.
Are you looking forward to it?
Yeah, we've done it. We've done it once as the Walls, and then we did it twice with the Stunning, and it's a brilliant show.
Yeah, a great festival. So it opens up at 4:30, and then you go along and you do the horse race, the races, or whatever, and then once the last race finishes, you guys come on at 9 o'clock.
Yeah, I think I'm not sure what time gates are at. I thought they were maybe a little later than that, but maybe it is 4:30. I should know these things.
Yeah.
I just know what time I have to be ready.
You
to
just
go.
Need to be there at 9 o'clock, ready to go.
we kick off at 9. I think the last horse race is around 8:45 or something like that, and then as soon as people come out from the race and the band are there, and we play like a full 2-hour set.
Yeah, it sounds like a great evening.
Lineup.
Sounds like
a great evening.
Yeah. So, but anyway, I'm kind of intrigued. You've had a very long career in music, but it started kind of, I suppose you moved back to Ireland in 1987 when you were born in England, is that right?
Well, no. The band started in 1987.
Okay.
I was born in England a long time before
Okay. Giving your age away.
I moved back from... My folks are from Ireland. Like, my mother's from the Liberties in Dublin. My father's from West Clare.
Yeah.
And they were part of that whole diaspora that would have emigrated in the 50s. So myself and a lot of my generation age group were born in the UK and places like that.
Yeah.
And so I was, I think, 4.5 years old or 5 years old when I moved back to Dublin.
Okay.
So I have vague recollections of it.
Yeah.
But, the Stunning started 30 years ago this day.
Oh, very
Not this
good.
Day, but just this day. Year, I mean.
Yeah.
Now this year.
Yeah.
And how do you come from a musical background? I mean, how did your music kind of begin?
More from, not really a musical background, like there weren't musicians in the family or anything.
Mm-hmm.
It was more from growing up in a household, I suppose, full of music lovers, you know, like when we moved back from London, we lived in my grandparents' place in Harold's Cross.
Yeah.
And the house was full of records, you know, because there was like 6 sisters and 1 boy, so there was 7 of them, you know.
Okay.
And even my grandfather had records, so he was into all the stuff like Dean Martin and Brooke Benton, Elvis Presley even, Perry Como. He loved all the crooners.
Wow.
And then various sisters would have had records like Ella Fitzgerald and Sarah Vaughan, and then there was Burt Bacharach records.
Yeah.
And then as the sisters got younger, we moved into Beatles territory and Motown and all that kind of stuff. So there was a great collection of music in the house. So when I was around like even 6 years old, I remember being taught how to put a record on the turntable, and that just started me off. And I think I started listening to Beatles albums that were there. That was like the first music I heard, really. So it was a good start.
Yeah, you had a great, as I say, you had a great collection to kind of to start off with. So
yeah,
how did the
very varied? Yeah, sorry.
How did the band start then? How did you get into playing in a band?
Well, I started. When did we? I'm just trying to think. We moved to the west of Ireland when I was 13 years old, and into Ennistymon, County Clare, where my father's from. And then when I left school there, I went to college in Galway. I went to like a regional technical college, and I wasn't really career driven. The main reason I went to college was because I was hoping to meet other like-minded people that I could start a band with.
Yeah.
And that was my main reason for going to college. It was just that. It wasn't an academic thing at all. And I ended up joining a band. There was a sort of a punk new wave band in college called New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
So I joined them as a guitar player, and after about 3 years of that, I packed it in and I started acting. I joined the Druid Theatre Company I was with them for a couple of years. That's kind of what I wanted to be then. It was like, to hell with music.
Yeah.
Be an actor. And so after a couple of years of Druid, I moved to Dublin to pursue an acting career, and ended up on the dole for about a year. I didn't get any auditions. I didn't even hear about auditions. There was this pre-internet days now.
Yeah.
So I decided to start a band. So in 1987, I put an ad in the Hot Press and started auditioning in Aidan Walsh's rehearsal rooms in Temple Bar. I started, the auditions were really just to meet people, to see who was out there.
I know.
So I started to meet loads of Dublin musicians. But then the band kind of came together over a bank holiday weekend when I was back down in Galway visiting friends. And the band kind of fell together then. So that was, 30 years ago.
Yeah. And then the first album, that was in 1990, so that was good going 3 years later.
Yeah, well, we put out singles. We put out, like, a couple of singles every year. Mm-hmm. The first single came out in 1988.
Okay.
Got to Get Away. So it was a kind of a country song. We were listening to a lot of... Steve Earle had an album out at the time called Guitar Town, and we all loved that.
Mm.
And so Got to Get Away is real. It's a real country stomping tune, you know. It's not like the kind of country that you hear these days, the country and Irish and that kind of thing. It's a bit more attitude to it.
Yeah.
You were ahead of the curve on that one, Steve. They call it alt country, right?
Alt. I don't know which is alt country, but... I thought, like, you know, bands like Wilco and...
Tupelo. Uncle Tupelo.
You know, Lyle Lovett and all that. I thought they were more alt-country. But I don't know what you call Nathan Carter and all that kind of thing.
So you've had three solid years of gigging and releasing singles. So you sort of, you know, you're a well-tuned machine.
They used to call us in the press the hardest-working band in Ireland.
Absolutely.
So I always... remember kind of being taken aback at that phrase at the time, because I thought everybody was just doing that amount of gigs. We were just gigging all the time, and sometimes 7 nights a week. But it was a different time in Ireland. That was a time when you could actually play shows around the country on a Sunday night and play to hundreds of people on a Sunday night. It's not like that anymore.
So were you surprised then with the success of Paradise in the Picture House when it was released? Was it
totally? Yeah, because we'd released four singles in the run-up to it, and the last single to be released was Brewing Up a Storm, and it was the first stunning single that got zero airplay. And
I read that earlier on, and I couldn't believe
it. The top 40. So we had the record label had organised a signing session in Golden Discs on Grafton Street for the single release, and we were there and nobody turned up. So it was just like that scene out of Spinal Tap. We were actually, the band were in the shop pretending to be customers. We were just flicking through records and no one showed. It was a complete flop. So we were really concerned when it came to the album release that it was going to follow suit. And then the album kind of, I think it went into the charts around, you know, in the top 40 somewhere.
Yeah.
But then each week it sort of, it kept creeping up, and then it sort of got that momentum on it, and it went to number one and stayed there for 5 weeks.
5 weeks, so absolutely. Yeah,
I think it's the best way for an album to chart, is to kind of to climb, because then you get a kind of it builds a momentum.
Yeah, I guess that's something we don't really have anymore. It's instant kind of success, but I believe, was it the first? You were the first Irish band debut album to spend 5 weeks at number one.
That's right. Yeah.
Huge feat. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And it was done as well. It was a self-financed album, so there wasn't a lot of that at that time. This was still the time like when major labels were signing bands. So there was a little bit of around that time, there was a lot of interest in Ireland because, you know, you had all these labels looking for the next U2.
Yeah, of course.
And so we had tried to get deals. We'd sent demo tapes off, but we were turned down by all of them. And so... we financed all the singles and the first album ourselves. So we basically paid for the recordings, and then we licensed them to an Irish label called Solid Records, which in retrospect was the best thing we ever did, because after 5 years, that album reverted back to us, so we own it.
Right, okay.
And it's continued to sell.
Still selling, yeah. Mm. But like I was just saying to a friend earlier on, like, I don't think any good night out in Ireland, you know, is a good night unless you hear Brewing Up a Storm and I have a great sing-along, you know?
Yeah. You just never know with songs. I mean, I wrote that in my bedroom on an acoustic guitar, and I had just spent the summer working in Germany, and I used to play at weekends in bars, and my whole kind of set was made up of Neil Young and Dylan and that kind of stuff, you know?
Mm.
So when I got home then, I was trying to write my own kind of Dylan tune, like Blowing in the Wind, you know, and Brewing Up a Storm kind of came out of that, you know. I basically went to a rehearsal with the lads and said, have a listen to this, but it was a strummy acoustic thing, you know, and it just wasn't working. And then one of the lads suggested that I try it on the electric guitar, and you can't really strum an electric guitar as such, so I started picking out the chords. And the riff kind of grew out of that, and that's how the song happened.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And speaking of Bob Dylan, you opened up for Bob Dylan in London.
We did, yeah. We did, when was that actually? I think that was around 91 or 2. We did 5 nights in the Hammersmith Odeon. Yeah. Well, it was called the Hammersmith Odeon at the time. And we never got to meet him, though, unfortunately.
Oh, no.
He was going through his hoodie phase when he was skulking around. But
disappeared in and out.
He even did the gigs with a hood.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
And then you opened up for the B-52s as well. I remember them.
That's right.
They were great. I saw them in the States.
That tour started a week later. So remember, we were hanging around London for a week, getting into all kinds of trouble. And before we headed off with the B-52s, and they were great fun.
Were they? Yeah. Yeah, they can't, you don't hear them at all. But I remember at the time they were a big band as well. They were huge.
Yeah. I mean, they were a big kind of, like, you'd hear their music in the clubs and everything. Love Shack and Lobster, all that kind of stuff. Brilliant band.
Yeah.
Over the 4 years you were together, really, that releasing albums, you had a huge success here in Ireland. And I think kind of one thing that shows that is, like, you know, your first time you've played Fayley, you've played, you know, a small during the day slot, and then, you know, you signed off, was it with a big headlining gig there?
Yeah, I think the first time we played it was the first Fayley in 1990, and it was funny because our album had just gone to number one, but the slots had already been decided, and we were on one of the first bands on. I think we were on at like 1 o'clock.
Right.
And but it was good job we weren't on any later, because we had never played anything that big and we just didn't know how to do it.
Mm.
So we were, you know, we were nervous, and going onto a big stage, we couldn't hear each other. I remember walking up to the mic, and when I went to sing, and I just got a blast of saxophone out of it, you know. It was like we didn't know how it all worked.
Yeah, whole new world, I'd imagine.
Playing in small clubs and bars and everything. So, you know, but we, over the next year or so, by the time the second Fayley came around, we had a lot more practice and experience.
I know this year is the 25th anniversary of your second album, was it? Once Around the World?
God, I don't know. I'm getting confused with all the anniversaries. All I know, it's 30 years this year since we started.
Right, okay. Now, did you just reissue it this year, or are you just planning to reissue it?
I'm in the studio at the moment, putting down yet another vocal on one of the songs. It's getting mixed at the moment, so myself and Joe are kind of busy finishing off little tweaks and overdubs here and there, and when it's done, then the tracks are getting sent off to be mixed. So half of it is mixed, and we're hoping to put it out in time for the Olympia show on the 6th of October.
Okay, that'd be great. And I know he's released a new single this year as well, Brighten Up My Life.
And that's going to be on the album as well.
Great. So what else have you got coming up this year? Obviously, is he going to release that, finish mixing it, release it? He's have a few more gigs coming up.
There'll be a few more gigs. We're hoping to do a few gigs around the country in October in support of the album release. And put out another single as well. So at the moment we're not sure whether to put out one of the songs that was a single before, you know, back in 92. There was a few singles on that album, Heads Are Gonna Roll, That Rises, and we've re-recorded them. They sound great. They actually sound quite contemporary. But there's another new song as well, and so we'll have to just play it all to a few people whose opinions we trust and try and figure out what to go to radio with next.
Well, you talk about contemporary, I definitely agree. I think your sound is, you know, it's totally up to date, and even your new stuff, like, you know, I have young nieces and nephews
who really didn't know what to make of Brighten Up My Life, you know, because we kind of thought, oh, people are going to hate this. It's like, it's just a big wall of guitars, and, you know, these days music has actually gone quite soft and acoustic. There isn't there's not an awful lot of rock and roll out there in terms of in the mainstream anyway. There's some great stuff, like I love that band Other Kin, great Irish band, and I just love the sound of good electric guitars, you know. And but we don't hear an awful lot of it on daytime radio, certainly here. So I didn't think Brighten Up My Life had a chance of getting any airplay, but people really liked it, and it did. It ended up doing great on the airwaves.
It's a great track, it really is. So, I loved it, yeah.
I think people still like to hear a dirty riff.
Well, you're good at them. Listen, we can't let you go without talking about Moonboy and your acting career.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so basically I wanted to know, how did you get that gig? Like, you know.
Well, I auditioned for the role, like I'm sure other people did as well. And yeah. I had, at that point, I'd been doing acting workshops, you know, screen acting workshops in a place called The Factory in Barrow Street. It's moved now to Bow Street. It's the Bow Street Acting School or Academy or whatever. But it started in The Factory in Baggots on Barrow Street. So I had been doing acting lessons there for a couple of years, and then I got to a point where I thought I should start doing some auditions, more for the experience of doing the auditions than actually getting them. So I wasn't expecting to get that one. I did the audition for experience, and then about a week later I got the call saying I got the part. So that was my first role.
It must have been so much fun, right?
It was great, really enjoyable. Yeah, it was a great experience. I mean, I was very nervous, you know, because I hadn't acted on the cameras before, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Playing another character as such, but it was a great experience, and I've had a good few years, actually. It's been going well.
Yeah, you've been in some other great shows, Vikings and lots of great stuff.
Vikings. I've got a film coming out next year now. I play the jazz musician Chet Baker.
I was going to ask you about this.
Yeah, it's a new Dutch movie about his final couple of days in Amsterdam.
Yeah, it sounds great. I love Chet Baker, and I can't wait to see it.
It's very dark.
Yeah.
It's all drugs, jazz, brothels,
all the good stuff,
smoking cigarettes. It's real film noir kind of stuff, and it's like he was a desperate junkie all his life, well, from about the age of 25, 26, and his life was a mess, really. And
terribly sad, actually.
The decline of someone who, he looked like a movie star and he was so talented, and the drugs just ravaged him, and everyone around him ended up getting ravaged as well. So he died in Amsterdam in 1988. He fell out of the hotel room window. Well, no one's sure, was he pushed or did he jump or what? So
excellent. Yeah, like
yeah,
I said,
that'll be out next year. He's another anniversary. He's 30 years dead next year.
Wow. Well, it all sounds great. You've lots of exciting stuff coming up, and I don't know if there's tickets still available for the gig on Thursday, but people should go out and check these out, you know. It's going to be a great night.
Cheers. Yeah, it's a good one. It's only €18 for horse racing and a rock and roll gig. Can't go wrong.
Sounds fantastic. Very good. Thanks a million for joining us this evening, Steve. It's been great speaking with you, and
thanks for having me.
Of luck with the gig and all the work for the rest of the year.
Thanks, Steve.
Okay, thanks, Steve.
Bye. All the best. Take care.